Welcome to the War in Ukraine Update from Kyiv podcast. I'm Jessica Ganawa, a lecturer in international relations at Flinders University in Australia. I'm excited to be chatting today with Jade McGlynn. Jade is a senior researcher at the Middlebury Institute for International Studies, and Jade is probably one of the most thoughtful commentators on the crafting of history and national narratives in the Russian domestic domain. Jade's forthcoming book, The Kremlin's Memory Makers, is a timely investigation of the orchestration of history and national memory in Russia to reinforce and galvanize Russian national identity. I'll put a link to the book in the show notes, and you'll hear that I ask Jade at the end of the interview. It comes out in December this year. I look forward to delving further into these issues with Jade today. Thanks for joining me today, Jade.
No, thank you so much for inviting me.
In your work, you discuss the importance of national memory, and you have this concept of a call to history that's important in that regard. Can you explain for listeners what is a call to history and why is that something important when we're talking about national identity?
Mm-hmm. The call to history is just a phrase that I use, and it's actually not my phrase. It's a phrase that I took from an interview with somebody who had quite an important role in a society that essentially delivers most of the state's historical event, its output of historical films, the camps and clubs that it sets up. And it comes from the sort of the Russian obrashenie k istorii, and that means a call to history, but also a turn towards history. And so what I use it to mean is the government's intensive use and propagation of its selective interpretation of history, to use this as a way to mold what it means to be Russian and to justify its own rule and its own policies and to project power at home and abroad. And the reason why in some ways the Russian term is so much makes more sense is because the call to history or the turn to history is partly a shift in political focus. So after it became clear that the Kremlin could no longer really provide much economic growth, so around 2012, when there became quite a lot of economic stagnation, there was a shift from, okay, if you sacrifice your freedoms, then we will ensure economic growth and economic stability. There was a shift from that social contract, as it were, to, okay, if you sacrifice your freedoms, we will give you a great state, you know, a sort of great power. We'll help Russia to become a great power. And that's also what this call to history means. So it's not just the process, but it's also that turning to a different means of legitimation for the state.
That's fascinating. Can you say a little bit more about that? Like how since 2012, the Russian state has used ideas of history or a version of history in order to galvanize support?
Mm-hmm, certainly. I mean, one of the things to bear in mind is that this isn't just something that's imposed top down. Partly the call to history is a call to awareness and to action that requires citizens to actively engage with and to reproduce the Kremlin's own use of history as an instrument of political argumentation. But it's not just something that's top down and imposed. I think it's much better to talk about it as a sort of co-creation of a narrative. You can't say it was forced on people, but you can't really say that it was designed organically either. And in terms of what it looks like, I think one of the important things is what I would call the banalization, in particular, of the Great Patriotic War, which is Russia's term for the Soviet experience of World War II, so from 1941 to 1945. And of course, there are obvious reasons why they might not want to think about 1939 and the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. But the Great Patriotic War is a bit different to the understanding of World War II. It's an idea of a sort of defensive war and the Nazis against the Soviet Union. And if we go back to this idea of ordinary people participating in the official memory making, it covers really quite a vast and, to be honest with you, sometimes bizarre range of activities. So you can celebrate your child's birthday party at a fairground partisan village, you know, based on the partisans from World War II, located, which is located in Patriot Park. Or there was, for example, an Echelon of Victory train museum that chugged across Russia and Belarus in 2018. It had sort of wartime exhibitions and propaganda posters. But it's also as well, it's not just these kind of amusing or maybe bemusing headlines, but it's also sits at the very core of the Russian political system. So in 2020, Putin ushered in sweeping new legislative amendments for the constitution that essentially amounted to a new constitution. And whilst a lot of people understandably focused on the fact that it meant Putin could stay in power until 2036, actually at the heart of this constitution, there was this codification of the duty of Russians to defend historical truth, which just means Russia's version of history, and to protect the memory of the Great Patriotic War. And there have been quite a few of these so-called memory laws, sort of saying what's allowed to say and what's not allowed to say. And on top of that, negative control, I suppose, there's also been this positive control, which is often, it's not immediately clear that it's the state that's organizing these, but there's also been these positive opportunities. So setting up of children's military history camps and clubs where they might go to after school or in the summer holidays, where they reenact historical battles, or sometimes you have different streams. So you can do historical propaganda where you learn how to blog about history and to, you know, aim this at foreign audiences. So it's really quite thought out. There's a lot of projects run by Vladimir Putin's party, United Russia. The scale of it is something that always shocked me, which is essentially why I wrote the book. But of course, another element of it is the media, and that's what we see. You know, this is something that's held quite sincerely, and I think tragically we see that now in the war, in Russia's war on Ukraine, where clearly they've sort of fallen for their own historical perversions and their own sort of obsession with the past.
It's so fascinating and so true. Like, a regime can propagate certain narratives, but they need to have resonance in some ways with the population in order to gain traction. And it also interests me that so much of this goes back to World War II. So if we sort of turn a little more towards Ukraine, have you noticed that since those first Russian-backed incursions onto Ukrainian territory in 2014, 2015, has there been a specific shaping of that historical narrative in order to create support for Russia's incursions into Ukraine?
Yes, definitely, very much so. So really, this is quite central even to my interest in the topic. So I lived in Moscow in from 2011 to 2015, and I had planned to really always live in Russia, but I left because I just was really so horrified of what was happening in Ukraine, what Russia was doing to Ukraine, but also how many people were just engaging in fantasy realities. So with the Ukraine crisis, I mean, from the very start, it was depicted in what I would say is sort of like a historical framing. It was historically framed as the Great Patriotic War. I know there's one Ukrainian researcher who's referred to the, you know, 2014 as the Little Patriotic War. But basically, I mean, from the minute that they started, anybody who was sort of a pro-EU, so pro-Maidan or anti-Yanukovych, was depicted as a Banderovitz, which in this case means, in Russia's interpretation, we won't get into Stepan Bandera and the history of him, but essentially, in Russia's case, it just is used to mean Nazi collaborator. Mm. It was incredibly intense, this idea that, you know, far-right extremists and Nazis had taken over power in Kyiv, and there was an urgent need for Russia to intervene to protect Russian speakers in Crimea from an impending genocide. Mm. And that was what was used to annex the peninsula, to annex Crimea. And of course, then there was the Russian Spring and this idea that people were rising up, you know, like these heirs, these Russian speakers in the East, these heirs to the Red Army were rising up against the Nazis in Kyiv. And that narrative has just continued since then, where basically in Russia, a lot of people genuinely, you know, people that I switch, I'm talking about professors, you know, who live maybe 30 kilometers from the border, genuinely believe these narratives because they were there like every single day. Just, you know, sometimes not the most outrageous things, but it's the little things that kind of lay these seeds or these threads that then the Kremlin has been able to pull together, to be honest with you, quite well, quite effectively in terms of the propaganda now and since February 24th, when of course there was the large scale invasion. But the idea here is that Russia is fighting World War II almost again. And there is a phrase that's become popular since 2014, which is Mozhem Povtorit, and it means we can repeat. And literally it means it refers to we can repeat World War II, like the successes in World War II. And whilst the military performance of the Russian army suggests that quite clearly they can't, there is this militaristic and jingoistic spirit. I mean, all countries have it, but I think for the reasons we've discussed, such as the extreme presence of World War II and of history in Russian society, it means that it takes on an especially intense character and perhaps an especially harmful one because Russia, of course, isn't a democracy. And whilst you will get jingoism, certainly we have jingoism here in the UK, but you also have plenty of people who will, you know, laugh at it, you know, lots of political satire, lots of people who will argue against it and different views. So I think, you know, laughing at some of Putin's comments around World War II, you could go to prison for it.
Mm-hmm. I feel like I have to ask you a very difficult question to answer, but given that you mentioned that you had lived in Russia and actually planned to keep living in Russia, so obviously have connections there with the language and with people, given that what we've seen of the military conflict in Ukraine, it's really not going well for Russia at all militarily, and yet this support seems to have so much traction. So does that support just keep being galvanized unless maybe there's an absolute military defeat? Or is there any way in which within the domestic context there could be a shift in perception or a shift in engagement with those narratives in that particular way?
Yeah, I mean, it's a big question and I won't pretend to have a definitive answer, but I think I'll probably sort of take it in a few sections. Maybe because I lived there in 2014 and in particular the shooting down of MH17, which of course as an Australian I'm sure that you'll remember very clearly as well, and the dismissive nature of some people who I thought were, I don't really know how to say this, but just sort of normal people, you know, with normal morals, who were willing to just to dismiss it. I found there was something quite difficult. And to be honest with you, since then, that's what my PhD, that's what the book that has now sort of come out of the PhD, and to be honest with you, all of my research has been looking into is why people who I don't believe that anybody's sort of, you know, born to dismiss massacres, or, you know, how does that process work? Why is it so powerful? And one of the reasons why it's so powerful, I think, is because, as you said in your question, you have these myths. And it's not just the myths of the heroism of World War II, but it's also myths about humiliation, that you know, there's this sort of boundaries of triumph, but also of tragedy and trauma that helped to form Russian national identity and probably all national identities. And you see, you know, these traumas of the 1990s and the collapse of the Soviet Union, which was a deeply traumatic time for many people. And Putin and others and the propaganda machine have been very adept at weaving these personal humiliations into the narrative of the country's humiliation. So it's not just that Russia was humiliated, I mean, in their view, by the NATO intervention in Kosovo. It's also, you know, that has become inextricably linked with people being humiliated when they couldn't afford, for example, when they couldn't afford, maybe when they weren't getting paid for 6 months in the 1990s, or when they couldn't afford, you know, basic goods in the 1990s. And in particular, it's been linked to Western sanctions. So it's very clever the way it's been done. And I mean, that's one of the reasons why I did such a large scale like analysis of the media, is to try to really unpick it. Although I went slightly mad whilst doing it. Essentially, that's the only way, is to kind of unpick all of the little threads, because those are the things that lay the context through which many Russians, and still over 60%, take most of their news from TV. Well, this was in 2021, but it's probably still similar numbers, at least. How most of the Russians, that's the context which they see it. And although many people may not necessarily believe Russian TV on domestic issues, actually, I think it's a majority. I think it's 53% off the top of my head, but these are figures from 2019, Levada Center, believe the media, the television on foreign policy. So that's a majority. I mean, the next point to come to is, okay, it does look from, of course, you have to really be careful using sociological research in a country as authoritarian as Russia has become since February and even before then. But there's also been some really good research into preference falsification. That means we can probably say with a fair amount of confidence that a majority of Russians do support what they believe is going on in Ukraine. Mm. But what I would caution is that whilst, of course, like you do see these horrific, like the phone intercepts in particular, and you know, there's plenty of evidence that there are just some people who are completely gung-ho for this war and it's horrific. you know, there are other people, including people, you know, that I've spoken to, people among contacts, who they do support the war, perhaps they don't necessarily oppose it, because in their mind there's been a genocide against people in the Donbass, against Russian speakers, you know, because essentially they genuinely believe it. And I know this is, I want to be careful with what I'm saying here, but I imagine what I'm saying is that they support an evil war, but not necessarily for evil reasons. There are some people who support an evil war, this evil war, and it is an evil war for evil reasons as well. But I think it's too much to just say, okay, all Russians support the war, so therefore they support what we know, maybe in the West, of what Russia is doing in Ukraine. Because if you just try to approach everybody like that, then it's not going to work, because it's a blanket approach. Some people support it for reasons that perhaps at their core are not, they come from a good place, but ultimately these people are choosing to be deceived, because for a long time you could access, and even still now you can access, the truth in the Russian language. So I think it's, then we have to look at why are they choosing to believe lies, and how do we cut through them? And it's very difficult when you're dealing with people where essentially I think even a lot of the triumph and the jingoism around World War II is based on that sense of humiliation from the collapse of the Soviet Union, but also from an unwillingness to address the historical traumas that have happened to Russia, you know, over the last kind of century, that are still in cultural and to a certain extent even in communicative memory, but also an unwillingness to address the traumas that they've inflicted on others. And I think until Russia can be at peace with its past, I don't think it's going to be able to be at peace with itself or its neighbours.
It's so interesting that you mention the concept of humiliation, but also historical trauma, which I think are both very important when we're trying to understand probably any country, but certainly it seems in this context. And also the fact that every person, I guess, when we're forming our identity, we always put ourselves as the good guy in some ways. Like, we're always the person who has good values, even if that leads to actions that potentially from other people's point of view look pretty horrific and not at all like we're the good guy. I guess I'll just ask you one more question, which is probably a short answer, I'm not sure. There was a long buildup of Russian troops on the Ukrainian border sort of in the end of 2021 and then the beginning of 2022, and US intelligence was saying, yes, there's going to be an invasion, but almost every analyst was saying, no, there is not going to be a full-scale invasion, because why, you know, what is Russia really going to get out of that? Were you surprised by the full-scale invasion when it occurred?
I was horrified. In some ways, I feel like it's still the 24th of February. Like, I don't think I got over the shock of Russia bombing Kyiv. I have to be honest that I had a baby at the end of December, so I probably wasn't following it as closely as perhaps I ought to have been, just because, you know, sleep deprivation and all of, you know, personal life intervenes. But I was following it a bit, but I presumed it would be, clearly something was going to come, but I didn't think it would be that full-scale invasion. The time when I realized, okay, actually this is going to happen, was on the Monday before the Thursday. So I think it was Monday the 21st of February, when they said they were going to recognize Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics, those areas that they'd kind of helped to set up and backed in the East since 2014. And the moment they were going to do that, I thought, okay, well, something really much bigger than I expected is going to happen, because makes no sense. I mean, Russia was in strategically quite a good position, because whilst everybody in Europe just was not interested in reopening that conflict, even Ukraine was just trying to, you know, kind of get on with its own development, it would never really have been able to join NATO with Russia occupying parts of its land. So really he was in a very strong position. So if he was going to annex or recognize, sorry, the independence of LNR, DNR, then he was going to go for all out war, because there would be no benefit to just taking Donbass. So the fact that that's what they say, oh, they're trying to do now, and of course, like, they're very open-ended about what they're actually trying to achieve in the war, it shows how much of a failure, an epic failure it's been. But I think even if I'd expected it, though, I don't think I would have ever been prepared for the sight of it.
Well, thanks so much, Jade. I really appreciate your insightful and nuanced analysis of the situation. And I know that I'm personally definitely going to be reading your book, The Kremlin's Memory Makers, as soon as it comes out. It sounds really fascinating. Just to remind our listeners, when does that come out?
So it's coming out in December of this year, so the beginning of December. So I'll update it on my Twitter. We're discussing the front covers at the moment. So
perfect. And so listeners can follow you there. That's just Jade McGlynn on Twitter.
It's Dr. Jade McGlynn, yeah. Thank you so much for your time, Jessica. It was a really interesting conversation.
Thanks.
You've been listening to the Update from Key podcast. Thanks to Mr. Smith for our theme music. See you next episode.